supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show is about pain. What pain does to us, how it affects our identity, our relationships, and our place in the world. And in turn, what we do with the experience of pain. We're going to take a look at pain of all kinds, from acute pain like a broken bone to chronic pain of fibromyalgia and arthritis or headaches. But we're also going to look at chronic psychological pain, the pain that comes from trauma or depression or even low self-esteem, even loneliness. In a way, I deal with chronic pain in my office every day. People call me because they are in some kind of pain. So the question that must be raised with a show like this, with chronic pain, is how do we live with it if we can't cure it? And of course, living with pain involves talking about it. And there's no formal universal language of pain. It's so very hard to articulate. Well, joining me to talk about the isolation of pain and how we can find voice for our pain, we have two guests, Dr. David Brio and Dr. Sean Mackey. David Brio is a physician, professor at SUNY Downstate Medical Center. He survived a life-threatening blood disorder. He's the author of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. Joins us by phone from New York. David, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Sean Mackey is chief of the Division of Pain Management at Stanford School of Medicine. He's also the director of Stanford Systems Neuroscience and Pain Lab, and he joins us by phone from Palo Alto. Sean, welcome. We have you, Sean? We do have you. Good. And of course, to our listeners, we want to hear from you. You have chronic pain at any level, physical, psychological. Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. David, let's start with you. I alluded to your blood disorder. Tell us about your personal experience with pain.
Well, shortly after I finished my residency, I was diagnosed with a very rare blood disorder and had to have a bone marrow transplant. And during the course of the bone marrow transplant, I had the opportunity to witness pain firsthand. And I think that for me, it was a shocking and horrifying experience.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, one of the things I think that was most sort of pressing in my experience was how sort of isolated I felt. And I was actually very lucky because I have an incredible sort of family. I have three sisters, my parents, who were with me, you know, around the clock the whole time. And yet, despite that, I really felt cut off from everybody, even them.
Yeah, that makes it worse.
Yes, that makes it worse. But there is this sort of sense when you have when you're in pain that there's no way that the person on the outside can ever know what you're feeling, and that you're sort of in this kind of thing alone. And yes, it makes it worse. I think that feeling is an integral part of the experience of pain, and it actually fuels the pain. If in some ways it can't be sort of mitigated, the feeling that you're alone.
Yeah, I'm a quadriplegic, and mm-hmm. I remember vividly when I saw my parents. I must have been in ICU right after it happened. The look on their face and the reaction, my reaction to that look, there was no words exchanged, but my reaction to the look on their face was, I'm here alone now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm experiencing something that they will never fully understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that was anguish for me.
Yes, yes. I think it's present always. I think pain sort of accentuates emphasizes the sort of separateness from that we are, between people.
Well, one of the things I want to explore as this show develops is, does it emphasize the pain of the separateness, the truth of the separateness, how much of it is real and kind of an existential universal truth, that business of separateness. I want to turn to you, Sean. The problem with pain is that it's so very subjective. I mean, you and I can each put our hand under the same temperature water, and I can, pull it out screaming, and you'd be okay with it.
And you just identified the major problem that we as a society have with trying to understand pain. It's that it is an extraordinarily individual experience. The science has shown that there is a wide variability to how we all respond to a given stimulus. You know, you used, for instance, hot water being one example, and wide variability in how people report a pain number. We see a huge variability to how people will express a disability to a given injury.
Why? And why is this? Do we know?
We think that some of this is due to genetics, but only some of this. Some have said 20 to 40%. Some of my genomics colleagues might push it up higher, 40 to 50%. A large part of this is environmental and learned. And I'm becoming convinced that more and more of this is based upon our early life experiences, how we were raised as children, what kind of injuries we experienced as kids. And all of that establishes memories in our brain that then shape and mold us to how we ultimately experience pain later on in life.
Well, if you're not doing anything next Monday around noon, our show is going to be on new research about the placebo effect. And it really, that also addresses how we experience pain, how we experience our lives. And a quick preview that, some research is showing that the placebo works even when the consumer knows it's a placebo.
You're referring to the recent paper that just came out. Fascinating work.
Yeah, I am. So I got a question coming back to pain, Sean. And David, I'd like you to weigh in on this. Why are we so damn judgmental? If my tolerance is high and yours is low, then I'm strong and you're weak.
Right. Well, I think this also hinges on this sort of the subjectivity of pain, and the fact that we still can't sort of disentangle ourselves with the objective sort of approach. Everything has to be based on some sort of objective thing. If there's no sort of lesion on the CAT scan, then there's no pain. If there's nothing that we can figure out, some kind of an objective reason that somebody's in pain, then it's hard for us to believe that someone's in pain. And yet, at the same time, we sort of acknowledge the fact that that the experience is a subjective one. So I think we're a little confused. While we acknowledge the subjective nature, we're upset when we can't find a good reason. And I think that's where the problems come in, because we tend not to believe, we tend not to legitimize the pain that doesn't come with an objective source of injury or damage.
Well, even though when it does, even when you can see the lesion, still the ones who can tolerate pain better are considered strong,
mm-hmm.
and others are weak. And how did we get there? Why is that?
Well, I think that this is simply part of our culture that, you know, we tend to think of people who are tougher, who can, if you will, cowboy up to the injury and to the pain as a being of stronger moral fiber. And, you know, we have perpetuated this over the years. And I think David hit it right on the head with this concept of this mind-body separation, this dualistic approach that, you know, we somehow think that the physical is entirely separated from the mind. And we are now evolving over the last couple decades in particular to this idea that pain is really a combination of not only those the source of injury and those electrochemical impulses that occur in the injury, but it's shaped and molded by, again, our prior experiences, our fears, our anxieties, our stress, our tension. All of that ultimately shapes how much pain we experience.
David, you know, when you talk about pain exiling us from the world, and you talk about your experience and I talked about mine, that the pain severs the interpersonal bridge. In psychology, there is one emotion that does that also, and that's shame. The experience of shame also severs the interpersonal bridge. And as you describe it, I'm seeing a lot of similarities between pain and shame.
Yeah, and I mean illness in general. Illness in general in this society sort of separates us from the rest of society. And I think there's gradations. I think pain is just at the top of the list because there's a sort of urgency in pain. When you're in pain, it often sort of rises, you know, to a sort of life and death pitch. You know, my God, here's where I really need to get somebody to believe me if I'm going to ever get some help. And yet, it's often difficult to communicate. It's often there are times when the person at the other end of the examining room doesn't necessarily believe this, and so I think there's an urgency when it comes to pain, and that's where it sort of differentiates that from other experiences. And I think the other thing is the longer it goes on this way, the longer the sort of disconnection that one feels with other people, and this is so especially true in the case of chronic pain patients, the worse it is, it just becomes a sort of vicious cycle, and it leads to all sorts of, you know, bad things, including depression and, you know, thoughts of suicide.
Yeah.
when there's no help in sight.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Candace on the line. Candace, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Hi. Thank you, Dr. Dan, for taking my call. And I want to say that I love your shows, and this is particularly germane to my problem. I feel very isolated. I have something called rheumatoid arthritis, I'm sure you heard of. And
yeah.
I'll make it fast, but the thing is, you know, it's such a subjective disease because everybody says, well, everybody has arthritis. And it kind of, and especially when I'm talking to someone like you, and, you know, forgive me for saying it this way, but, like, I would have a hard time even, like, explaining my pain to someone like you because how dare I, you know, you can't walk. And, and so the guilt that I have because I don't look sick, people think, what is she complaining about? She's a weenie girl. And I'll take, you know, that off the air.
But I'm just wondering
if that is a common feeling. And well, you know, you're describing how people feel almost suicidal because you feel so disconnected from people. They don't believe that you feel this pain.
Candace, Stick with us. You there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Don't go away. You said you're going to take it off the air. I don't want you to take it off the air. Okay? Just
okay.
Hang in. So here, let me. I guess I'll turn to you, David. So I'm hearing a lot of things from Candace. I'm hearing some sense of isolation or shame. I'm hearing anger. I'm hearing loneliness and depression. This is pretty typical.
I think it is. Again, rheumatoid arthritis is a chronic condition. So this is something that's been going on for a while, and it becomes sort of, it feeds on itself. The longer it goes this way, and the longer there's this feeling that one is not sort of being listened to, being believed, is awful.
Sean, let me turn to you. And do you know of any research or even anatomically, is the isolation of pain, does that make it worse?
It does make it worse. But what I would also say to Candace and everybody else out there is that isolation is a normal feeling. Our brains are hardwired to do exactly what Candace is doing and what other people are doing after an injury.
Which is what?
Which is this concept of illness behaviors. Think back to any time we get a cold or a flu, we tend to, you know, sit on the couch, cuddle up with the blankets, and we have people take care of us. It's a normal process of an injury and healing. And the good news is that in that short period of time, we heal up and we go back to normal. But when we have chronic pain, those illness behaviors that are mediated by a flood of chemicals in our brains, they don't turn off.
So tell me about what Candace can do to make her life better. She's not going to change the world, and I don't even think this radio show is going to change the world. Maybe, but doubt it.
Well, I'm optimistic. I think what you're doing is great, and I'd like to think that it is going to make an impact. And if we can at least make an impact on a few people, then it is changing the world. And what I would submit to Candace is that what she's feeling is normal, that there are people who can help her to move beyond that feeling of isolation. It's usually finding a good multidisciplinary pain program that includes components of physical treatment with psychological and behavioral types of treatment to help people to learn how to better manage what they've got. Because unfortunately, we can't cure rheumatoid arthritis, but we can help people learn how to better live with it.
There's also a lot of self-help groups, and there's a lot of research about self-help groups and how helpful they are, where Candace could be with kindred spirits and talk about the interpersonal bridge.
The only thing I would add to the self-help groups is try to find one that is very proactive and positive about skills management, because there are also a number of self-help groups that, if you will allow me, are more bitch and complain sessions.
Yeah, yeah.
And that just gets you into an ever-worsening spiral of woe is me.
Yeah.
And I'd just like to pipe in that one of the sources, I think, you know, Candace is basically showing a sort of primal need for us to sort of communicate, to sort of speak out about, to speak this kind of thing and get it sort of out there into the open. I think you just got to keep trying, and somebody is gonna listen. And I think the hope is that if you can somehow sort of communicate that feeling to somebody else, well, that's the way that feeling of isolation is going to be lessened.
Well, let's do this, David. At the for the second half of our show, let's talk about how we can talk so that people can listen, and maybe that'll be helpful for Candace. Candace, I asked you to hold on. I didn't give you room to open your mouth. I hope this was helpful.
Was, and you know, your shows help me in so many ways, and you are bridging isolation for people like me, and I appreciate your show. Thank you so
that
much.
That makes me happy. Take care of yourself.
Okay.
Sean, I know you've got to go after our break, so I want to bring in a question here about some of your research. Excuse me, it might be a little bit out of order, but it struck me as interesting and important. There was a study you did about the empathy of pain.
Ah, yes.
So,
yes.
You know, we're talking with Candace and we're talking with David about this big gap, but there's also empathy associated with that.
Indeed, and I was motivated by this when I was picking up my son at a daycare center, and he was a big kid running across the floor to go and hug me, and was running way, way, way too fast, and went down on his knees to slow down and slid across the linoleum floor and just smacked his head into the wall and bounced off. And you could have heard this gasp from all the parents in the room as he saw my son just bounce off the wall. And I experienced just a huge amount of pain at that moment, and I'm sure every parent can understand what I'm saying. And I walked over to him, and I felt his head and realized he was okay and did what I usually do, which is I high-fived him and said, way to go, buddy. And he laughed. And so I decided at that point I needed to come back to the lab and study it. I needed to understand, why did I experience more pain at that moment than he did? And so we got Stanford undergrads to come in and for people in the outside community, and we caused them physical pain, and we also showed them videos of people experiencing pain. And what we found is that when we put them into a brain scanning system, an fMRI scanner, that the same areas of the brain get lit up, they get activated when you experience your own pain and when you see somebody else in pain, which, you know, I think it's fascinating in that it means that pain transcends our physical being and extends out to, you know, the very social framework of our society. And it's a good thing it does, because if we didn't have empathy, if we didn't experience other people's distress and pain, let's face it, we would have died out as a species a long time ago.
I'd like to ask you, Sean, but it all sort of hinges on the seeing of the pain. Because then how do you sort of explain the fact that there's been sort of traditionally pain has been sort of undertreated in medicine, in a discipline where people are supposed to sort of be more sympathetic to one's sort of suffering? How do you explain that?
And I think I can take a shot at that, and I would say that's a flaw with our basic medical training, and that as physicians, we are brought up in a very biomedical model of training. Find the disease, find the cure for the disease, move on. And with pain, you can't do that. It is, as you've pointed out and as Dan has mentioned, it's an extraordinarily subjective experience, often without a clear connection to objective injury or disease. And so we're left with physicians, with our medical community, not really understanding pain, and we need to move more into that direction, that it is a subjective experience.
Well, when we come back from our break, I want to talk about what physicians need to learn about pain. But I did make a promise to you, Sean, that you'd be out of here by 12:30, and I am 40 seconds ahead of time. So I want to thank you so much for joining us. You've been wonderful. I wish you could have stayed longer.
I appreciate the opportunity to be with you, and really enjoyed being on your show. Thank you.
Great. Sean Mackey is chief of the Division of Pain Management at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's the director of Stanford Systems Neuroscience and Pain Lab. David will be continuing with us for the rest of the show. He's a practicing physician, professor at SUNY Downstate Medical Center. He had a life-threatening blood disorder, and he's the author of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. We've got a couple of lines open. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about pain, physical, psychological, and probably even spiritual. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Lucy by Damian Atkins, now through February 6th, when Vivian, a brilliant scientist, is called upon to take care of her estranged 13-year-old autistic daughter. She searches for answers to her daughter's mysteries and is forced to confront her own personality. Lucy challenges conventional wisdom about normalcy, motherhood, evolution, and autism. For tickets, 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
Supporting WHYY, St. Joseph's University's Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support aids the growing community affected by autism, offering social skill building, education for students, and resources for caregivers. Enrollment for the spring sports program begins Saturday, March 19th. Athletes with autism spectrum disorder ages 7 to 18, regardless of ability, learn new skills and develop friendships. Details at kinneyautism.sju.edu. The Kinney Center at St. Joseph's University. Empathy and empowerment for all.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about chronic pain, how to deal with it, what it does to us, and how we can rebuild what I've called that interpersonal bridge, because pain can be so isolating. My guest is David Biro. He's a physician, professor at SUNY, Downstate Medical Center. He's had a life-threatening blood disorder, but he's also the author of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. We've got our lines are filled, and I will get to the callers in just a second. But speaking of language, David, I was in a doctor's waiting room. This goes back a couple of years. And there was nobody in there. I was in there with my nurse, and there was another guy there. All of a sudden, he lets out a big sigh. Nothing. Nothing else. And then wait a couple more minutes, same thing. And, you know, Sean talked about those motor neurons, this kind of empathy that goes with pain, and I felt something, but I didn't quite know what to do with it. And he was obviously in pain and struggling to find language for pain. But that wasn't really the best way to do it.
Well, it was a form of language, maybe not the most articulate, but in some ways, some gestures, sighs, can be sort of articulate for this feeling that we have that feels like there's just no words for it. So in a way, that was a sort of expression. But yes, there's also the need to be a little bit more articulate about it, because you know that only goes so far, that gesture. And so there has to be other means to go a little bit farther, and I think this is where, you know, the imagination sort of comes in. There's no question that pain is difficult to express, and there's a lot of reasons for this. I think probably the most important is the fact that for the most part it's deep inside oneself. It's inaccessible to the usual modes that we have of finding out about something. We often can't see the pain. We often can't see what's happening within our bodies when the pain hits. The other problem is that it's often not connected to an object that we can see. So there are some inherent problems with language when it comes to pain for these reasons.
And making things even more complicated, David, you don't make a distinction between physical and psychological pain, the pain of trauma or depression, the pain of baggage we might carry from our childhood.
I don't, because most people don't either. And that's reflected in the language we use. When Sean talked about seeing his son bang his head, he talked about pain. Now, he's not in any physical pain. He's talking about emotional pain. When we lose someone who we love, you know, we speak about pain. So if we truly believe that pain is this subjective experience, then we have to believe people when they say that they're in pain in these situations where we know for a fact that there's no the physical pathways of pain aren't being activated.
And when someone says to me in my office, when I'm working with a couple, and she might say, I feel disconnected. I need to be connected to stay in this marriage. That's a statement of pain.
Yes, I believe that. And I believe the experience, what is felt at those moments is very, very much, is very, very similar to physical pain. In those moments, and we could see that when we start to go from the gesture of pain, the sigh, the scream, to more sort of articulate forms of expressing pain. When we start beginning to say, well, what does the pain feel like? Give me a sense of the quality of pain. Well, in those instances, people start to talk just as if they were talking about physical pain. They'll use the same kind of metaphors. They'll use the most common way we talk about pain is through the weapon. You know, they'll also talk about, well, it feels like, you know, I'm being stabbed.
Yeah.
When my husband told me that he's, you know, with another woman. That's what it feels like.
Well, and they use language we all do, like broken hearts.
Yes.
Broken
yeah.
hearts.
Yes.
Listen, I've got a ton of people waiting to join this conversation and pick your brains, and I'm starting to feel guilty here.
Okay.
So, and that's painful. So let's talk to Julia first. Julia, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dan, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your program. My question is how to deal with the exhaustion of pain, chronic pain, because if I don't deal with it, then I stop doing the routines that help ward it off. You know, there are exercises and all kinds of things, and actually food routines. The food routines are easy, the exhaustion, it was funny, I got up this morning, was going to go to the gym, and I was so exhausted from the pain, I went to sleep, and I woke up and turned on your program, and here was this program about pain.
Yeah, I knew that was happening. That's why we did this program.
Thank you.
It's magic. It's magic. So let me turn to you, David. How do you deal with the exhaustion? I mean, that's automatic. That's part of the package.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the thing about pain that just keeps on going. It just wears you down. It wears you down, and when you get to the point where you feel like there's no sort of letdown, there's no sort of end in sight, it could be very stressful. I have no easy solution to this problem. Obviously, you know, and I'm. Let me confess. I'm not a pain doctor. I don't see patients with pain. My sort of my expertise here is more from a language, you know, perspective.
Well, let me weigh in then, if I may here, Julia. You know, Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, brought mindfulness meditation to this.
It took the words right out of my mind.
Yeah,
I actually do MBSR.
Yeah, I mean, his program was based on pain. That's how it started, was treating pain. And one of the things we do with pain is we brace up against it. It's our body's natural reaction. When we feel pain, we clench up against it and we fight with it. And when you start fighting, then it gets into your head and you begin to tell yourself stories. Oh my God, this is worse. Oh my God, this is going to go on for the rest of my life. Anything that starts with oh my God is going to make pain worse.
And yeah, well, I guess it's when it wakes me up in the middle of the night and I start to do a body scan, which comes from Jon Kabat-Zinn's program, and I just can't get through it and I can't get back to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, you know, I mean, then I go and I ice and I'll drink some herb tea or something like that, but it's exhausting.
Well,
I keep working with it and I keep taking you know, meditation course.
Yeah, let me turn to David. And Joya, I'm going to thank you for your call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And so, David, I want to follow up on that. Is it reasonable to ask someone in chronic pain to stop clenching around it and just let yourself feel pain? When you're in pain, stop wrestling with it. Just feel it, and it's going to last as long as it wants to last, not as long as you want it to last.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the sort of you can either sort of try to push it away, or you could try to accept it, focus on it, or go the opposite way. And I think probably it can work either way. At times, you know, the focusing on it helps. At times, the pushing it away helps.
Right.
I mean, in reflecting on sort of my own experience, the body scan thing helped me. When I was really in a lot of pain during my experience of a bone marrow transplant, I remember that it actually did help me when I sort of imagined what was, you know, I talked a little bit about the fact that there's this inaccessibility of the pain. You don't know where it is, what's going on, but if you could somehow see it, see what's happening, I think that actually helps a little bit.
Oh, wow.
Because not only do you see it, but then you could sort of imagine ways of dealing with it. So, for example, in my case, I had these sores that went from, you know, my mouth all the way down my GI tract from all the chemo and the radiation, and it was, you know, excruciating. In fact, I couldn't talk at that moment. But I sort of imagined these little fires that were raging down my, you know, esophagus and so on, and that was helpful in a way because I could see it.
Right.
It also sort of helped because, well, then I could figure out how to do something with it. If I could just, you know, put the fires out, that would help.
Well, you know, when we talk about pain tolerance or emotion tolerance, I mean, what I would want, what I try to do with me is when I feel pain is to know it better, just to sit there with it. So I don't have to fight with it anymore, just to sit there with it. So I'm at a point now where I'm no longer afraid of my pain. I don't wrestle with it anymore. When it comes, you know, it comes. I'm not thrilled because I hate pain. But,
right.
You know, and when it goes, I'm grateful.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, however you get to that sort of adjustment and accommodation, obviously, it is extraordinarily beneficial in living your life, especially if it can't be avoided.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see if we can squeeze a call on before we take our next break. We've got Roy. Roy?
Oh, yes, hello.
Hi, Roy.
Thank you. I'm calling about the question how pain affects relationship. As a person, I have a chronic lung problem, and I'm single now, and I'm really fearful of what someone would, you know, find in me as one who needs oxygen. Especially at night.
As one who, I didn't hear the last...
Needs oxygen.
I need to use an oxygen...
Oh.
Enhancer, yeah. And I have a sister who has a really bad hip, and I look at her, and, you know, she's single as well. And so, how do people deal with that?
I guess the first question I would ask is, how do you feel about it? What's your...
Embarrassed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't... Yeah.
Yeah, that's
But, you know, it's somewhat embarrassing. It's also a burden on a partner. Your pain is a burden on your partner.
That's it is, but that's a really big assumption. Right now what I'm hearing is that your pain is a burden on you, that as of this moment, you can't find compassion for you, for your suffering, so you're assuming, then how could anybody else? And boy, do I know that feeling, and David, I'm sure you know that feeling too, where we reject ourselves because we're in pain, because we're suffering. We reject ourselves. I mean, I didn't even think I was human after my accident. I didn't think I was good enough to be part of the species. And then it evolved.
Well, I feel there's a lot more going for any of us than the pain we feel. But you don't know if somebody else is going to see it.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know somebody else is not going to see it either. Either going to see it or not going to see it, or it's not going to make a difference. You don't know that. You're just assuming, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're assuming that it's going to have any adverse...
It's going to be a factor.
...adverse effect on all of these relationships, but you don't know that.
And, yeah, you're assuming that a person who would come to you, a man or a woman, would have the same feelings about your experience that you have. And that's a big leap. I mean, they could feel repulsed and run away. Or, you know, they can feel compassion for the man that you are. You don't be open. You know, just be open to whatever could happen. And please be open to your own experience. Find compassion for you, for this person who suffers and needs oxygen. I appreciate your call, Roy. I do wish you the best. We've got to take a short break. David, we'll be back in just a minute. We got some more calls. We're talking about pain, chronic pain, whether it's physical or psychological. We're specifically talking about the language of pain, which is the title of my guest's David Biro's book. It's called The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. David Biro is a physician, professor at SUNY Downstate Medical Center. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, St. Joseph's University's Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support offers a safe environment and programming for those who struggle with autism as individuals or caregivers. Enrollment begins June 27th for the low-cost summer camp. Camp Kinney brings the meaning of summer to children with autism ages 3 to 14 and offers recreation along with opportunities to interact with neurotypical peers. Details at kinneyautism.sju.edu. The Kinney Center at St. Joseph's University. Empathy and empowerment for all.
It's a day marked every year by hearing from opposites on the political spectrum, the anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, which has shaped debate on reproductive health since 1973. One new point of contention, telemedicine abortions. We'll explain what they are as part of our look at 38 years of legal access to abortion in America. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about chronic pain with David Biro. He's a physician professor at SUNY Downstate Medical Center. He's the author of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. David, do you still experience pain?
Fortunately, I do not experience much pain. My experience with pain, as with illness, was a very short, intense experience over my bone marrow transplant. But I learned a lot in that time, and since then, from talking to people. And I just want to make one, plea. We keep sort of emphasizing a lot of these negatives, the isolating aspects of pain. But my plea is that language in this case, and I'm thinking here in a very broad sense of language, can be like medicine in the way it can provide sort of relief, and in the way it can sort of reconnect us with other people and lessen the isolation. If we can sort of find the right words, if we can represent how we feel in some ways through words, through pictures, through whatever sort of means that we can think of to be able to put our feelings in some kind of a form that we can then sort of show to other people that are important in our lives, I think it's an amazing kind of thing.
Everybody
who's successful in doing so feels that way. At least that's what I'm hearing.
You used a magic word that I want to come back to, and I think what you said was critical. You said put our feelings in some kind of form, and you know, that's been my experience over 30 years. I can't describe what it's like to have quadriplegia, what it's like to have nerve pain, and God knows I can't describe what it's like to have no sensation over my body. But I can describe the emotions, the sequelae. I can describe feeling vulnerable and mistrusting my body. I can describe the loneliness and isolation that comes with it. And when I use the language of emotion, that's universal language that people can relate to and that they're not afraid of. And
right. That
rebuilds the interpersonal bridge.
And it makes you feel better. You know, there's a satisfaction in that. Both because it reconnects you and for your own self. It sort of validates the sort of amorphousness or elusiveness of the pain you feel. So I think it's just very important that we try and we don't give up.
Right. Well, we can't give up on ourselves. Let's get another phone call in. We've got Susan on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi, I'm on the air.
You are.
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
I'm not by radio, so I can't tell if you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes.
What happened with me is I have MS, so I'm always in a certain amount of pain, and sometimes the pain gets very, very bad, gets worse. So that's an exacerbation, and I have to go into the hospital for treatment. But the last time it happened, I felt the pain. It got worse. But you have to wait 48 hours to see if it's a pseudo-exacerbation or a real exacerbation. By the time I contacted my neurologist, he said, get to the hospital. I was having a heart attack. Mm. And I did not know the difference in the pain of having a heart attack or the pain from my MS.
All right, so let me turn to you, David. And how did we get here? And, you know, what can be done for people like Susan? She's not alone. Susan, thanks for your call.
And you know, I've been sort of talking about the existential benefits, so to speak, of communicating pain. By being able to sort of express what we feel more sort of reconnected with others. But there's also, and this case right here shows that, there's also a practical benefit in being able to express in an accurate way the feelings. Now, there are probably qualitative differences in MS pain and cardiac pain. And these are some of the things that are being worked on, you know, in a research format, seeing what kinds of words might lead us to one diagnosis of another. So there are practical reasons that we need to facilitate, you know, communication between patients and doctors.
Well, you know, I'm thinking as I listen to Susan and listen to you, You know, it seems like the words "I feel pain" mean simply "I need care."
Mm.
And you know, a physician who hears those three words, you know, they are supposed to take care of somebody who needs care.
Mm.
It's just that simple. Now, what the care is, okay, that's when we need your medical expertise. But I need care, man.
Yeah. It is. Pain is a cry for help. It's a sign, you know, to the body, that to the person. Let's not even say it to the body. To the person, that something's wrong, and we need help. And hopefully, the person who hears the signal, and that's the person who's experiencing the pain, as well as the person on the phone or in the exam room, is hearing that as well, and empathizing, and hopefully the areas in the brain that Dr. Mackey was talking about are being activated during that sort of interaction.
Let me ask you this. We've only got a couple seconds left. I hope and trust you are teaching medical students and residents about
pain. I am. I do so. And I think, you know, it's not, my feeling is that to really understand the patient's, you know, perspective, you have to be a patient.
Yeah, well, that's true. David, unfortunately, we are out of time.
Okay.
I'd love you to come to Philly and teach pain to our doctors, and you'll get a free meal out of it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care of yourself. David Biro is a physician, and he's written The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. Earlier, we heard from Dr. Sean Mackey. He's chief of the Division of Pain Management at Stanford University. Next week, we've got a fascinating show about some new research on placebos. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org, and I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer par excellence. We want to thank Stephanie Pena for her help on the show and wish her luck this semester as she goes back to Temple University. And we want to welcome our new intern, Emily Haas. Welcome, Emily. You did a great job today. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host.